Pop the. We might say the meanest things. Pop the. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging. Our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, Pop the. You belong to us. Pop the.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 17 of the Pop Dose Podcast. I'm Dave Lifton. We've got a bit of a different show than usual for you today. Later on, you'll be hearing an interview that Jeff and I did with Gorman Bichard, who is the creative force behind Color Me Obsessed, a film about The Replacements, which is a new documentary about one of the best and most influential bands of the 80s. We had a very small window of opportunity in which to speak with him, and unfortunately, Jason was unable to join us that day, and that is why it is just the two of us. And speaking of those two jerks, let's give a warm welcome to Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. Gentlemen.
Hello.
Greetings, fornicators.
Greetings, fornicators.
I have to mix it up sometimes. It can't always be subfuckers.
No, it can't. It can't. No, please. Everybody, we're recording this on a rare evening. Everybody drinking?
I got a little Woodford Reserve on the rocks here.
I finished my drink already.
You never stop.
I wish that were true. Unfortunately, I have to stop sometimes. What about you, Jason? You got apple juice?
Cranberry tonight.
Cranberry. Is it in a box or a glass?
Neither. It's in a Capri Sun thing. It's a little bag with a straw.
That's kind of like a juice box. A
little hint of lime juice. I'll have an apple and Eve.
You're on your own for dinner tonight, aren't you?
I am. Thank God there were leftovers in the house.
I was just going to ask you what you're doing for dinner. If it's like ramen night or...
No, I had some pasta. Jessica had made some pasta earlier in the week. Some green peppers and broccoli and other shit in it. I don't know. I just ate it.
I have such fond memories. You have no idea. I have such fond memories of the days when you would have to eat dinner on the train.
I still have to do that.
And it was always some hellish leftover that, like, I think, wasn't there a day when you brought, I don't know, like a stale sandwich for dinner and then you forgot it on the train?
And I had nothing to eat. And you were like, oh. And you're like, oh, Leah made homemade pad thai tonight.
And Jason's eating iceberg lettuce and a ding-dong for dinner.
Your mom had a ding-dong for dinner last night. Sorry. I still eat dinner on the train. I still, you know, when I got work into a rehearsal or something, sometimes my only time to eat is that 45 minutes I'm on the train.
Puts you in a bad mood. That must be why you were one of those guys that attacked Jar Jar Binks on the train the other day.
That's right. That was me. That was me. I was the fat bald guy.
Did you hear about that, Dave?
No, I hadn't heard about it.
Improv Everywhere. Have you heard of them?
Yes, I have.
They did a sketch last year called, I think it was called Star Wars Subway Car or something, where they went into the subway and they recreated, like, the opening Leia and Darth Vader scene from Star Wars. So their April Fool's joke this year was they had Jar Jar Binks go on the train and, like, harass people, and then a couple of people on the subway beat the crap out of him.
I think it was three guys sitting next to each other, wasn't it?
They were standing by the door, and they punched him in the stomach and kicked him in the nuts, and it was obviously all staged, but it was pretty funny.
Oh, that part was staged also.
They tried to act like there was a police investigation,
The bullies were pressing charges or something, and that's why they had to make the video public or something. I can't remember what the reasoning was, but whatever it was funny. I haven't seen that on the subway.
Just the Saw Lady.
Well, just the Saw. I haven't seen the Saw Lady in a while. I hope she's okay.
I hope she's okay.
Wait, I'll yell out my window, Saw Lady. Because I think she lives in the store. It'd be funny, right? It'd be very funny if I just called out my window and it was like the bat signal, the saw signal. Reach my mouth out the window and just go.
Son of a bitch.
Have you noticed that since the last episode, I've now taken to just saying you son of a bitch whenever you insult me?
I got you good on Facebook.
You did.
that was beautiful. Yeah. Would you care to explain?
Well, there was a morning when, you know, our friend, I put friend in quotes, that jive-ass cracker Jeff Gable, has a so-called humor site. And he put up an article the other day, and when people, I think it was our friend Bill Childs, tried to go to it and inform Jeff that his site was returning malware results. And so when I posted a link on Facebook and I said that Jeff may not be able to prevent his site from spreading malware, but he knows how to bring the funny. And Jeff relatively quickly fixed the problem and responded with a comment saying, what did he say? I can virtually guarantee that visiting my site has far less risk of getting you a scorching virus or something like that. And I said that Jason's mother left me an almost identical voicemail the night before. And so it started this whole little conversation.
And then Jeff said, I claimed the assist on that.
Yeah, he did. And then 2 or 3 hours later, Jason just pops up with, you son of a bitch.
And then I wrote, I love you guys.
Yeah. I actually like the one from yesterday when Jeff found an article about babies with misshapen heads and said, put it on my page and said, see, you're not the only one.
There was that thing I put, this is actually, I think, somewhat legitimately interesting, that thing about Archie, the Archie comics. I had no idea that these were going on, but apparently what's the company that publishes these shitty comics? Archie Comics?
I believe it's Archie Comics.
They just call it Archie Comics. They have a whole title, a whole series based on what would happen if Archie married Betty and Veronica, right? Isn't that the deal, that there's two separate timelines in these books?
Yeah, it's like a sliding doors thing, you know? It's like there's two different scenarios. And
it's an Archie.
Yeah, and it's like a serious soap opera.
You said they killed somebody?
Yeah, they killed Miss Grundy, the teacher. The old hag teacher. They killed her off. I mean, she was, you know, according to the comics, she was probably like in her 80s. So, you know, it's not like they didn't murder her.
The Archie murder mystery. The only adult that I remember is Mr. Weatherby.
Yes, and Mr. Weatherby was at the funeral mourning. He said Miss Grundy was his true love, which made me throw up a little.
So, yeah, I put this link on Jason's wall because he's the only person I know who really read Archie Comics.
I was a fan of Archie Comics.
I remember the shit you gave me on Melamus a couple years ago for saying unkind things about the Archie.
I'm just remembering that
it's true.
Installment.
What's his name singing the
Ron Dante?
Yes, thank you.
Wow, Dave, yeah. That's impressive. Yeah.
Well, because I remember because he was also Barry Manilow's collaborator for years.
Really?
Yeah, he wrote a lot of he co-wrote a lot of those songs. He wrote a lot of the lyrics,
except for "I Write the Songs,"
which was Bruce Johnston.
Bruce
right?
Johnston,
that's right.
Jesus Christ, this is a frightening level of Barry Manilow knowledge that's coming out.
I have two Jewish older sisters.
Did you guys see, we got a press release today for
Sony, and I had a piano in the house. So
for Sony Legacy's upcoming release schedule.
Yeah,
and there's
Manilow.
A Barry Manilow duets compilation on there.
Yeah.
And appended to the end of the little blurb on the press release, it says something like, this is a timely CD release to coincide with Barry's, I think he's playing Vegas for a certain amount of time, like 2 months, 2 weeks,
He's had. He's been playing Vegas for a few years now.
Oh, no, it isn't Vegas. He's going somewhere else. Paris, London.
No, Paris is the name of the hotel where he's booked.
He's going to be in New York, New York.
Barry Manilow. Well, it's all uphill from here.
He built this website. He built this website with Brad Gupta. Built this website. He built this website with Brad Gupta.
Jeff Giles.
You know, speaking of artists past their prime, Matt Wardlaw sent an email to me, and you see you're already laughing because you know it's some shitty artist.
No, I was thinking Matt Wardlaw's past his prime. Be funny if Jeff's, speaking of artists past his prime, Matt Wardlaw just left it at that.
I can't rag on Matt too much because he set up a Bruce Hornsby interview for he and I on Monday.
Oh, it's definitely happening. That's great.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. But he sent me and Jason a press release about Russell Hitchcock of Air Supply making a solo album recorded in Nashville.
Excuse me a second.
Yes, let that sink in, Dave.
Right.
Okay.
I think he was beating his head against the wall.
Either that or he's masturbating to the thought of Russell Hitchcock. Oh, Dave, it's disgusting. Guy shaped like a pear.
It's like a melted crayon stuck to your leg, Dave.
Grimace. Well, you guys have never seen my apartment. I've got a giant poster of Grimace on the wall. So.
Isn't the album, isn't it called Nashville?
I don't remember. I was just going to ask you. It's either Nashville or the Nashville Sessions or whatever. Isn't it a double album, too?
Is it? Oh, man.
I think it is. I think it's two CDs of Russell Hitchcock by his goddamn self.
Yeah, you read this better than I did. The Nashville Sessions, two CDs.
Well, I got about that far, and then you listened to samples, which I did.
And they were not that bad, except for the fact that some of the backing vocalists have that country twinge that Russell Hitchcock doesn't have. But he sounded great.
Ugh. Anyway, I'm trying to convince Jason to interview him, and he won't do it.
Jason, you got to do it.
You call me out on the podcast like, you know, I can't get Jason to do it privately or in front of Matt Wardlaw. Now I'll get everybody on his back. I'll think about it.
Who's better prepared to interview Russell Hitchcock than you?
Graham Russell. Johnny Lightfoot, the bassist from Air Supply.
Jim Steinman.
There you go. Lots of people.
I think it would be great. I think it would be like you interviewing Richard Marx. I think it would be great.
I will think about it. Just seems like a lot of work. Like Richard Marx, that was no work. I had a million questions I wanted to ask him. I can't think of anything I want to ask Russell Hitchcock other than how their song wound up on the Ghostbusters soundtrack.
But see, this is fucking fascinating to me because you know more about the Air Supply catalog than anybody I know.
I'm not that big a fan of Air Supply. Like, I love their greatest hits, and I like seeing them in concert.
But don't you have all their albums?
No.
My mind is blown.
My mom probably has all the records up to 85, I would say. And then after that...
Which was the first one you bought, wasn't it?
She technically bought it. I'm not sure if it was the very first one, but it was either that or Big Bam Boom. They were purchased the same day. I remember that specifically.
Well, all right. I thought you had all their albums and that you were... I mean, you've certainly seen them live enough times.
I've seen them live twice.
And that's enough times.
That's enough times. That's touche.
That's two times too many. This is the anthem, just like it is. Please take the anthem, just like it is. This is the anthem, lift 'em, love 'em, baby, just like it is. Just like it is.
It's funny, I heard on NPR, so I was thinking actually back to the Guilty Pleasures episode that we did when first time the three of us talked, and this morning I was listening to my, there was on the NPR Music Interviews podcast, they were talking about the 40th anniversary of the release of Take Me Home Country Roads, which is written by Bill Danoff, and I was remembering like you talking about Starland Vocal Band.
Vocal Band, that's right.
Yeah.
It's like he had never even been to West Virginia. Huh. When he wrote that, he's from Massachusetts.
That's written
by. And he said he could have put Massachusetts in the meter there.
That's
right. But it just didn't sound good. And I'm thinking that it's kind of Payback, because the Bee Gees wrote, "I think I'm going back to Massachusetts," and they had never been to Massachusetts when they wrote that.
Yeah, written by Bill Danoff and I think his wife too.
Yeah,
his wife Taffy.
Yeah, they'd planned to they'd written it with the intention of giving it to Johnny Cash.
Huh. I did not know that. For all that I am a Starland Vocal Band fan.
Well, that wasn't a Starland Vocal Band song. That was a
Denver
song.
Right, but you think I would know the backstory behind all of Bill Danoff's hits. Right.
He's also a John Denver fan.
That's true, too.
Yeah.
Well, then you need to subscribe to the NPR Music Interviews podcast.
All right.
Because you get stupid shit like that every week.
Right. Jeff's already imagining what I was going to say.
I'll put that on my list of things to do.
Put on my list of things I have no time to listen to.
Right. Well, you're getting all that bike time and the running and stuff.
Yeah.
You should go swimming with your iPod.
Might make some of the tunes sound better.
Right.
Russell Hitchcock's new album sounds great underwater.
And only underwater.
Right.
Do you bike with your iPod? I'd be willing to bet you don't.
No, I do not.
I knew it.
Too dangerous.
Yeah, quite frankly, when I'm biking, I get pissed off when I see somebody with their iPod in.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll run occasionally with my iPod, but I actually, more often than not, if I'm running with the team, no headphones at all. But if I'm running by myself, I will often run with a metronome program on my phone.
Wait, no, just a metronome and no music?
Yep. Just a click.
Oh my God.
Like a click, click, click. Well, it helps.
I will fucking kill myself.
It helps keep a steady pace?
Yeah, it helps to try and keep my feet landing at the right pace.
I swear to God, I think I would punch myself in time to the metronome. Until I was dead.
Until I was dead.
Because you run, you know, a good 4.5-5 miles, right?
Yeah, that's about it. 3 to 4 miles.
That's a ways for a click, click, click in your head.
Yeah, I mean, after a while, I don't really hear it anymore, and I don't necessarily always follow it. Yeah, no, I can understand where you're coming from.
Why don't you just what's your BPM? Find songs that match that BPM,
right?
And,
yeah,
and preserve my sanity.
That's a good point. I'll have to look for songs that are between 85 and 90 BPM, and we'll see.
That's most of your collection.
In my mind, I don't know. In my mind, that's Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees.
All right.
I don't know if that's actually true. You guys heard about that, right? That whatever the BPM is of Stayin' Alive, that's the proper tempo at which to do chest compressions.
No.
Right.
Really?
No. Look it
up. I have heard that, yeah.
Yeah.
The story I remember is the one for the tempo of or the drum track on Jive Talkin'.
That's what?
That was the sound of the bridge that they drove over to get to the studio.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
No.
It isn't the literal sound. It wasn't like they mic'd it from the bottom of the car, but they were in the car either going to or coming back from, what is it, Criteria?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's where they went, yeah.
They had to go over a bridge to get there and to go home, and bridges are, they're pieces. And so the car was driving over the lines in the road, and that was the tempo. That was the beat that they heard, and that's how Jive Talkin' started.
Whether that's true or not, that's a great story.
I can imagine, like, they would have had to have been driving with Arif Martin.
Yeah. I've seen it, I think, in 3 separate Bee Gees documentaries, which makes me want to hit myself again, but
yeah, that's...
it's at least the accepted story now.
Okay, that's interesting, because I have done that where, like, I've been in, where I've been in cars and driven over, you know, bridges or whatever.
Yeah, next time you're on a bridge, imagine Jive Talkin'.
Just sing Jive Talkin'.
It's just your Jive Talkin'.
Oh, where's my melodica?
You didn't bring your hooter to the podcast?
No, I can't. I can't. The baby is sleeping downstairs. Not my baby, folks. the people who live downstairs, their baby is asleep, so I can't make too much noise.
They've asked you not to play your hooter at night?
No, they haven't. They haven't asked, but I'm trying to be a good neighbor.
Wow.
Trying to be neighborly to my friends downstairs.
I just assumed that in New York, everybody did whatever the fuck they wanted, and...
Well, if you're the neighbors on the other side of my wall,
exactly.
That is absolutely true.
Is that still going on?
Yes.
The sound of resignation in your voice.
Oh
there
my
was
God!
Brilliant.
It's just. I think the last time Jessica started yelling, both of us were yelling, "Put it in her butt," and. But there was no, it was like they just didn't hear us at all. And then I thought I heard multiple voices, which made me think that either something fucked up is going on, or maybe they were filming a porno. I don't know.
They were in the zone, man. They couldn't hear you.
And you know what the fucked up thing was? Is I was totally tempted because our fire escapes are next to each other. I was tempted to hop my fire escape and go over to theirs and just knock on the window and be like, cut it out.
In the nude.
I don't know. Oh, please. I would never do that. They'd probably invite me in. Sure, we could use a fifth. Not a good idea.
You know, do you follow the Wall Street Journal music critic? I forget his name.
Jim Fusilli.
Yeah, there he is.
Yeah, I follow
him. I don't.
Jason, do you follow him?
No.
So, the other day, this guy rarely... RT's, I can't believe I just said that. He rarely retweets other people's stuff, but
LOL.
Yeah, the other day he said something about he passed along something that somebody else said about an album that was their favorite to fall asleep to, and his additional comment was, "Is this a compliment?"
Right,
and I immediately thought of Jason.
for what specifically?
Because I know you like to fall asleep to new age music with a sleeping mask on.
Last night, actually, I put on Lullabies for Getty, the Damwell's Lullaby album that just came out, and I had to turn it off. Yeah, no, that deserves a clap. It's a good album, right? But I had to turn it off halfway because it was getting drowned out by the people next door, and they weren't having sex. They weren't having sex. They were just talking really loudly. You know, it's like everything they do with their mouths right up against my wall. I don't know why, but
there must be something you can do.
I am desperately trying to think of something that I could do that would actually stop them. But you know, embarrassing them in public.
Can we soundproof your bedroom?
That's not the solution. The solution, I'm trying to find a solution that stops them. Not that it stops me from hearing them. I'm trying to find a solution that stops them from doing it. That makes them think we
Because
can't
even
do
if
this.
We can line your bedroom with egg crate foam, you're still going to be angry knowing that they're making noise.
Well, look, that is a solution, but I would, you know, my you know, vengeful side would much rather do something that stops them, you know, like okay. So did I ever tell you the story about when I was at sleepaway camp and I was in a band, and I gave my camera to one of the kids at the bunks in the bunk next door, and I asked him to take photos of my band while we were on stage. So he takes the photos, and I didn't get my camera back that day. I think I got it back. I forgot about it. So 2 days later, I get my camera back. So I go get my pictures.
And they
developed.
Were pictures of him wiping his ass with your toothbrush. I heard about this. I thought it was an urban legend.
So I get the pictures. I get the camera back. And I had to I got the pictures developed, right? And I get the pictures developed, and there's all these pictures of one of the kids in the bunk naked. Like they just thought it would be funny to use my film up and take pictures of this guy
They were right. It is funny.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Well, whoa, wait. But what I did...
Especially back in the days when you had to get film developed.
Exactly,
right? Some
stoner in a photo mat. Look at it. Jerking off in the photo mat booth.
And then look at me being very excited about getting my photos back, right? So I got the photos. And I didn't tell his sister, but I knew his sister. And I knew her, you know, fairly well. Like we kept in touch over the winter break and whatever. So, after I got the pictures back, I mailed them to his parents.
Ooh. I was hoping you were going to say that you convinced his sister to take off her clothes and then mailed the pictures.
I thought the ending of that story was pretty good.
That is a good story.
I mailed the photos to his folks. I never heard back, but I just thought that is a
well,
good way of getting
Well, that's what you need to do. You need to record the people across on the opposite wall from right. you.
And find out and where find their families out. Live. And
yeah.
Or just set up like a YouTube channel.
Yeah. Are they married?
I don't know. I just want to punch them in the face. I hate them so much.
Set up a YouTube channel that's Astoria fucking roommates or something like that.
But the thing is I totally get the feeling they would get off on that. I think they're filming things anyway. I think if I dared to go looking for like Astoria amateur porn, they'd probably show up, and I don't want to know. Although it would be interesting to see those videos and hear if you can hear Jessica and I yelling in the background. Shut up!
Jessica asked for royalties.
Right? Our voices are on that.
Put it in her butt. That's nice.
I agree.
Of all the things to yell at 2 in the morning.
Okay, and coming up next is the interview that Jeff and I did with Gorman Bouchard.
Have fun, guys. See you on the other side.
Our guest today is Gorman Bouchard, the writer, director, and producer of Color Me Obsessed, a film about The Replacements. As the title suggests, it's a documentary about the legendary, groundbreaking 80s punk pop band. Gorman Bouchard, welcome to the Pop Dose Podcast.
Glad to be here.
So why did you decide to make a documentary about The Replacements?
Well, I've made 7 or so narrative features, and I had always wanted to do a documentary, but I never found a subject that really I was completely passionate about. And I was actually in the original version of this film. A woman named Hansi Oppenheimer started making this movie probably about 5 years ago, where she was just interviewing fans. And I was interviewed because I had The Replacements as fictional characters in my first novel, The Second Greatest Story Ever Told. God sends his 18-year-old daughter to save the world, and she just happens to be your typical 18-year-old, has sex, drinks, does drugs, loves rock and roll, and she goes on an interview on TV, and someone says, well, what's your favorite band? And she goes, Replacements, and within a week, they're playing Giant Stadium. So she had interviewed me because of that reference. And then probably about 3 years ago, I get an email from Hansi, and she says she lost her edit. She lost her editing machine. She had no way to finish the film. She had no rights to the music, none of this stuff. So I said, all right, well, let me think about it. And I really started thinking about it in a way that, okay, this is a band to me that I hold in highest regard. I personally do think they are the greatest rock and roll band of all time, bar none. I'm counting every band that's ever existed. And they're gods to me. They are what I believe in. And I started thinking, I was lying in bed. I remember lying in bed next to my wife saying, you know, people believe in God without ever seeing or hearing him. Why can't I do that with The Replacements? And I started thinking, it's like, what if I do a music doc where you never see or hear the band? And I started falling in love with that idea because it was a crazy idea. It literally in my head, I'm going, it can't be done. And that just made me want to do it all the more. And as I thought about it more, you know, here's a band that bucked tradition and spit in the face of success at every turn. What's more fitting? You know, the band that for their first music video, where in a time when music videos were making rock bands, shoots a stereo speaker. What's more fitting in terms of a documentary about them where we never see them? They obviously didn't want to be on camera. And in a way, I'm sort of like, you know, holding up their wishes.
And I think the whole angle of the God, you know, making a film about God without seeing them is an interesting angle because, you know, the stories about them on stage, oh, they've got this guitar player who's wearing a diaper and his teenage brother is playing bass, and the idea that they could be drunk off their ass doing covers all night. You know, they almost took on, as the years went on, this almost mythological quality to it, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You never knew what you were going to get. But if you went to a show, all you wanted to do was talk about it. And everyone you knew who loved them, you know, what happened at the replacement show.
And they did kind of, in that respect, subvert the formula for bands. If you saw any other band that could be as half-assed on a given night as they were, you'd never see them again. But for their fans, the diehards, that became a trademark of theirs. Oh yeah, I was at that show where they did this. You know, as opposed to just, you know, somebody like a Springsteen who just goes out and gives a killer show night after night.
Right. Right. And you're absolutely, I mean, occasionally you'll have a band that, you know, I mean, I think Ryan Adams was trying to, despite the fact that he doesn't seem to admit to being, you know, influenced by the Replacements. I mean, he basically just ripped their sound off completely. Let's admit it, Ryan. I mean, you have a very pretty wife, but come on, let's admit this.
Yeah, Come Pick Me Up doesn't sound like anything that Paul West.
Oh my God, forget go back to some of the Whiskey Town stuff. There's a couple of songs that, like, right. Every once in a while, I'll jokingly play to my wife. I'll like, hey, listen to this, and she goes, "What is that? Like a Lost Replacements track?" And it's, you know, it's Ryan Adams or it's Wilco or it's any of these bands. I mean, there is no rock and roll after, and there is no new band that started after like 1987. That doesn't owe everything to the Replacements and Husker Du.
No good band.
They changed rock and roll. They saved rock and roll. Otherwise, we would be listening to synth pop. We'd be listening to Human League. You know? Right. I mean, even the whole punk movement of, you know, 1977 on in England was pretty much dead by 1981. You know? I mean, The Clash had become a reggae band.
Yeah. Elvis Costello had become George Gershwin.
Exactly.
Joe Jackson had tried to become Duke Ellington.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so the Replacements basically, and I do say Husker Du as well, because I think the two of them together, they basically changed the face of American rock and roll.
Very much so.
Well, I wanted to talk about, you know, the decision to do this without the Replacements' involvement and without their music. I wanted to find out what went into making that decision. I assumed that maybe it had something to do with the fact that it would have been easier to get it made without having a clear music rights.
Nope. Never even considered it.
Already answered that question for me.
Yeah, it was never even a consideration. I say this completely honestly. If the Replacements had come to me and said, "You can have rights to everything, you can talk to us, you can do whatever music doc you want," I would have passed on the project.
Now, have you heard from any of the band members since this has come together?
Only the fifth member, Peter Jesperson.
Because I know that, you know, people have been waiting to see this for a little while now.
Yeah.
It's been, as you say, in the works for quite a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I took it over from Hansi, I mean, one of the big things was, you know, I get all the footage that she sent me, and I ended up not using any of it. So we started from scratch.
Once it came together, did you feel any pushback from people based because of the fact that the Replacements were not directly involved, that there wasn't any music?
Oh, I mean, you'll always hear negative things, but it's like, I've been doing this for way too long. I don't really care. My feeling on that case is that go and make your own fucking documentary if you want music in it. I said this once to someone, and my wife says I come off sounding, I don't say it the right way, and maybe I'm not going to say it right now, but when you're making something like this that's as personal, and you invest 2-3 years in any film you make, you got to make it for yourself. I have to be happy with it, and honestly, it's until I'm completely happy with it it won't go out. I will never put my name to it unless I'm completely happy with it. And ultimately, yeah, I'm not really swayed by other opinion. I've been doing it's from doing it way too long.
I was asking more in terms of like the festival circuit, you know, people.
Oh, you know, and in that world, people either seem to get it or they don't get it. And in the festival circuit, if they don't get it, all you get is a generic, you know, thank you for submitting, you know, hope you submit next year, that kind of thing. You know, so, or you get the person call, you know, emailing you saying, "We love this movie. What do we have to do to get it? We'll throw you a gala, you know, whatever you want." And it's literally with this film, it's one or the other.
Now, one of the things that's really interesting to me about this movie is that, as you say in the promotional materials, it's not, I mean, it's about the Replacements, but it's also really about the nature of and the community aspect of fanhood.
Yes. I think that watching this film, you don't have to be a Replacements fan to like this film. In fact, you can even hate the Replacements. But if you like any indie band, and any band that has, you know, in growing up, a band has really affected you in one way or another, this movie will affect you. I mean, it'll make, I know one film festival programmer who says, I don't like the Replacements. I still don't. But it made me, after watching your movie, I spent the entire week going to see live bands. because I just had to, like, you know, and I know other people who said it just made me break out all my old vinyl.
We're also in an era where it's more acceptable than ever to be part of a cult. I don't mean like Scientology.
Right.
I mean, you know, a cult of fanhood. So I guess when I read that, it made me think even in broader terms than the music or indie bands, but just that, you know, pretty much everybody's part of some kind of passionate niche now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what I responded to about this movie, despite the fact that I am a Replacements fan. I thought that was a pretty interesting tack to take.
Well, I think that, I mean, there's two ways to look at it. I mean, I think that it's that whole, I used the line in one of the trailers where it's like, you know, it's fun being one of the people who knows. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that the people who know about this band realize just how important they were and realize now what they were witnessing.
how did you decide which people to talk to? Did you kind of draw up a fantasy list, or was it?
Well, I mean, I after doing Friends with Benefits, my last feature, I decided it took way too long to make. I decided I was going to get a lot of projects rolling, and we actually had four features in development: two narrative, two documentaries. The other one being about New Haven Pizza, which is probably my other crazy fantasy that I'll get into arguments with people about. And so we did an interview with Jack Rabid of Big Takeover magazine.
Sure.
And I remember vividly after that interview walking out with my cinematographer, turning to him and going, we've got a movie. Because his storytelling. And, I mean, he was just, he so recanted beautifully what it was like to be a Replacements fan in 1983. And, you know, knowing the band, talking to the band. I mean, and it was just like, I knew right then and there that this being just like the first interview, that a few more of these and we were fine. And people after Jack Rabid, people started coming out of the woodwork. And by the time we hit, that was in November of 2009. By the time we hit Minneapolis in June 1st of 2010, forget it. I mean, we were just, I mean, I remember saying to my Minneapolis producer, Jan Ratter, I said to him, you know, we're not there to sightsee. Have us working. I swear to you, we had 8 interviews a day. It was like we'd start at 8 in the morning, get back at 11 at night for 14 days straight. It was crazy, you know. But it was good. I mean, you know, there was just this passion about the band. And for the most part, we got to speak with virtually every person we wanted. I mean, there were maybe like 4 or 5 people that I would have probably loved to have added to the list, but, you know.
I saw that George Wendt, best known as Norm from Cheers, was on there.
Yes.
I think that's probably the strangest one. I think pretty much the rest of the world pictures him as being like an REO Speedwagon kind of guy.
Oh, no, but the thing is, you know how I knew he was a fan was, don't you remember he was in the Goo Goo Dolls video where their car got, not Goo Goo Dolls, Soul Asylum video, where their car got stuck?
Huh. I actually don't remember that.
It might have been Runaway Train. I don't know. I loved Soul Asylum for the first 3 or 4 albums, and then they became commercial.
Right.
But yeah. So,
but and, I give them and the Goo Goo Dolls the Bob Seger pass for selling out.
But yes. But I'm telling you, I don't like the Goo Goo Dolls music. I love, again, the first 3 records are wonderful, right, punk records, and then I don't know what the hell happened. When you see the Goo Goo Dolls in this film and listen to them, You won't like their music anymore, but you will completely respect them. I promise you that. Anyone who has a problem with the Goo Goo Dolls.
I saw one of those early Goo Goo Dolls shows. So.
No, I'm saying, but what they say about the Replacements will make you respect them. Yeah, it's a really good interview. But George went and we, you know, so we got in touch with him, and he just went off the deep end having to be in it. Literally, he had, I think it was his nephew or something, film him on a flip camera as I was doing an interview, sort of like you guys are doing right now, and send me the file.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just interesting because, I mean, I guess if you're getting videos from, you know, from people on their flip cams and at the same time that you're doing your own, does that create a problem in the editing process?
No.
In trying to get things to match up and
no, so on. I mean, I hate saying it, but my feeling is it's a documentary. So you can... It's more about what's being conveyed than how it's being conveyed.
It doesn't have to be pretty.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be pretty. I mean, and the funny thing was, right before the sound mix, I just happened to catch Fahrenheit 9/11 on don't know, HBO or something. And all of a sudden I'm watching and he's interviewing somebody. No, it was, I'm sorry, it was Bowling for Columbine. And he's interviewing someone and the sound was atrocious. It like, they sounded like they were in a wind tunnel. And I'm like, okay, that makes me feel a lot better. So, because I didn't have any sound that was as bad as the sound right there. That's actually usually the biggest problem is sound, not so much video, because you can have fun with video. But I literally, there are a couple people that I filmed in iChat. Literally, I just aimed the camera at my MacBook Pro, you know, and recorded the sound separately. But yeah, I mean, so you just basically have this kind of like blurry kind of weird image of them. You know, so that wasn't really an issue. And there's so many, I really tried to, in this film, it really does cover every aspect of the replacements myth. From handing over the demo tape to the breaking up in Grant Park. And I think we covered basically every single legendary story you could have possibly, you know, wanted to hear is in this film. Every album is covered. You know, I mean, it's long for a reason. We really tell their story. You will not walk away from this wanting to know anything more about the replacements other than I want to hear their music now.
Have you started thinking about DVD release?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I start thinking about a DVD release before I start filming the first frame.
Okay. I asked because I just watched not too long ago the Harry Nilsson doc.
Yep.
And the DVD release has about another movie's worth of bonus footage.
We're going to put... my goal is about 10 hours of bonus footage.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it sounds like you probably had a lot of footage that you couldn't use.
Amazing. And I mean, honestly, I could probably run the Grant Hart interview in its entirety. It's wonderful. You know, and there are a couple of people like that, but him especially. I mean, and we're in the dressing room in the basement of 7th Street Entry, one of the most wonderful locations we had because it was as pure rock and roll as you could possibly imagine. And he was just wonderful and sarcastic and intelligent and funny. And it's like, as much as I love Husker Du, it made me love him even more.
Now, you funded this via Kickstarter.
Kickstarter and credit cards, yeah.
How did that work? I mean, was it frustrating to have to work in stops and starts until you had raised enough?
Oh, no, not at all, because I always was ahead of the – I always did it ahead of the game. When I was raising money for one thing, you know, I was already working on something where I had the money for it, you know. And my feeling on this always was that even if I raised nothing, I was going to fund it myself.
Yeah, this is something that I wanted to talk to you about because you, to put it mildly, are a very busy artist.
Yeah, I keep kind of busy. I'm honestly really looking forward to a couple of days just doing nothing in Tampa. I really am.
you got a lot of stuff going on. You have a lot of projects that you have released, and you have a lot of stuff in the works. Mm-hmm. And you hear a lot these days about how tough it is to. To make a living in artistic pursuits, but you're making it work.
Well, and it's like, it's weird because I go to a lot of film festivals, obviously. And I think one of the big problems with filmmakers today is that they don't treat it like a job. They treat it like it's some artistic mission from God or something, you know, and I remember once being at a book signing and someone said, "What's your inspiration?" And I said, "Paying my mortgage. This is my job." Is anyone who claims writer's block is full of shit. They basically can't write. That's my feeling on writer's block. If you say you've got writer's block, it's like, then just give it up and go, you know, go be an accountant or something. And the thing with filmmaking is it is a full-time job. I mean, over the past like week and a half, we've got an incredible amount of publicity. Well, that was me and my wife spending every moment that we had, like putting together this incredible press release list in a really well-written press release and getting it out there and working Facebook, working Twitter, you know, working every single blog that posts something about this movie or about The Replacements or about music docs or about the docs that are playing South by Southwest and why the hell this one isn't here. I mean, we worked everything. And all of a sudden, next thing we know, Pitchfork picks it up. And once Pitchfork picks it up, then Rolling Stone picks it up. And I just did an interview with the New York Times yesterday. So it's like, wow, it paid off. But it's, yeah. It's, I mean, there were nights there. I mean, my wife runs a really busy coffee shop at Yale. I do this full time. And literally, it's like after her being at work from 6 in the morning till 6 at night one day, we're literally sitting there the day before we put out the release at our kitchen table eating pizza with our laptops open. Her saying, "You have this guy." It's like, "No," and I'm putting it on my, you know, and just going back and forth. And our dog's looking at us like we're crazy, you know. So it's you can't just sit and let it come to you. I mean, if you want to be distributed, right, you got to go find a distribution. I mean, you got to make it work. And one thing I always tell a filmmaker is, like, if you're sending out your film already to film festivals, you should be already working on your next movie. Because if you're just putting all your eggs in one basket and that basket drops and all the eggs crack, you know, it's like you have to start over from scratch.
You also work in a lot of different mediums. You know, it's one thing to maintain the discipline necessary to move your art forward, but how do you maintain the discipline to work smoothly between filmmaking and writing and photography? I mean,
it's sort of all the same in a way. It's still, I mean, and for me, it's always just, it's all about storytelling. And I mean, writing a book is, yeah, I mean, is really just, you know, it's making a film without the pictures and without the acting.
Oh, because writing is a full-time job too.
Yeah, yeah. And that actually has been more of my quote-unquote real full-time job. You know, the one that sort of pays the bills. I found that making a documentary was very much like writing a book. Because here you had basically, you were now presented at the end of the shooting with all these words, the English language, except that they're being said by other people. And now you've got to tell the story using the words you have. Right. And I found that to be honestly fascinating and amazing, to the point where one of the two new movies I'm working on, we're doing it almost very cinema verite, where it's like we're not scripting it. We're sort of, I have one actress that I really like working with who's brilliant. I could just tell her this is sort of what the scene's about, and she'll just nail it on the first time. And which is not usually the case. So then I'm going to end up just putting the story together in the editing room, you know. And then of course one of the other movies I'm doing, which is a horror film, is completely scripted and we stay right to the script, you know. But ultimately I like telling stories, and I like the different mediums are fun, because sometimes it's nice to just sit in a room with just your laptop and no one bothering you. Sometimes it's nice to have the craziness of the crew and the cast. You know, I love editing. Editing is probably my favorite part of any of this, because now you have, you know, your tools are in front of you, you know, and you get to add music. You get to go, I mean, I love going to find, you know, music for certain scenes and stuff, if that answered the question.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's very instructive, you know, the old kind of image of the artist is the guy who sits around waiting for a patron to hand him a check, mm-hmm, or a bag of gold or whatever. And you're right. You have to have the discipline and the, for lack of a better term, business sense to hustle.
Yeah. You know, and Kickstarter is an amazing thing, because, you know, yeah, I mean, if you put up something that people like, you know, all right, so I'm pre-selling the DVD, but I'm only selling the movie and the DVD. So if they love the movie and they want the DVD with all the extras, they're still going to have to go and buy it. You know, I mean, I'm selling the poster, which I have anyway. You know, I'm limited t-shirts, because, I mean, someone asked me if we're selling merch, and it's like, I don't have time to sell merch. So if someone wants like a t-shirt for this, they need to go on Kickstarter and get it, because once this last Kickstarter is done, I'm ordering the t-shirts and that's it.
I think that's it. The whole thing with Kickstarter kind of goes back to something that Jeff was talking about earlier, the idea of today it's being so much easier to be part of a niche.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And how that helps in terms of funding Kickstarter. You just have to, you know, yeah, you still have to work it. But I think back to like when the replacements were around, so much of this was transmitted through word of mouth, mm-hmm, and the fanzine culture as well, that it was a lot harder to find it.
Do you think if the replacements were, I mean, if Kickstarter was around and the replacements were together, you think they'd still be toughing it out?
Still together today, or if they were just forming now?
I just mean it's a lot easier to subsist on a much smaller audience these days.
Yes,
you know, and the replacements were never intended, were never seemingly intended to be part of mass culture. That's what you had to be part of at the time, and now you don't.
I think The Replacements, very much like what I said about, you know, I ultimately make my movies for myself. I think The Replacements were very much about, this is our party. We're having a good time. Right. You can come along and watch if you want, you know, or not. We don't really care. And I think that that was part of what made them really great, that they just didn't care. They cared, but they didn't really care. And I think that that attitude is, you know, really what separated them from every other band. You know, I mean, you know, you have Charlie Sheen going nuts right now about partying and stuff. And it's like, I wish Bob Stinson was alive, because Bob Stinson would just be like watching him on the TV going, you know, like laughing, going, amateur. You know, I mean, come on, you know, especially when he compares himself to, like, you know, Keith Richards or something. Keith Richards has got to be like, you know, just like, you know, he must have spit up his coffee when he like heard that, you know. It's like, come on, Charlie.
I would say the fact that Graham Parsons couldn't hang with Keith Richards couldn't last as long as Keith Richards shows just how much Keith Richards has done.
You know, I would like to have seen Keith and Bob together. That would have been an interesting one. Mm. They came from a mold unlike any other band, really. I mean, because even the Rolling Stones, I think, ultimately wanted success.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that's all they wanted.
And I don't think The Replacements really cared. Not in the beginning, anyway. Not up until Pleased to Meet Me, you know?
Right. But I also think that there is an interesting aspect of what you were saying about that, in that they cared, but they didn't. At the time, because it was the... Everything was about getting onto a major.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have an eye towards success, because that was the idea of an independent band subsisting just within their own fan base and the technology that exists today to keep expenses lower didn't exist. So you kind of had to go through the system, which forced them into a situation that they didn't necessarily feel comfortable with.
Right, right, right. And I think that ultimately that might have been the beginning of the demise. It's funny, when you watch the movie, I mean, The Replacements broke up on July 4th, you know, 1991 at Grant Park in Chicago. But when you watch the movie, I'm sure a lot of people will get the feeling that The Replacements broke up when they kicked Bob out of the band.
I would kind of agree with that.
Yeah, and that has a lot to do, I think, with the moving to the major and so forth.
Right. The story that I had heard, I guess, in the Spin article, when Bob died, that kind of told a story, was that Bob was trying to stay sober, and there was a show that went really well, and a bottle of champagne was passed around, and Paul said, take a drink, motherfucker, or get off my stage. Did you get confirmation of that from other sources? Because I think it was Bob's widow, Bob's ex-wife had told him that.
Yeah, I actually had got confirmation from it, but I didn't use it in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of kept it a little bit. I tried to stay away from the incredibly negative aspects of the band. And because there was still just really one person saying that, that to me, it was sort of like kind of inflammatory, and I think there are other reasons. I don't think it just comes down to that. Because I have a lot of other people saying that you know, things like they actually wanted a better guitar player. There's also some things you hear about him recording on Tim. I mean, there's some stuff on that I didn't know, you know, when you're talking to like Tommy Ramone and the recording session of Tim. That, you know, surprised me. I mean, so, I don't think it just comes down to that. I think and from some of the actions that you'll get in the film, like there's an amazing show that's covered from five or six different people, which happened at City Gardens in Trenton, New Jersey. And it's called, the bootleg of it is called The Late Bob Show, because Bob shows up like into the fourth song. And, you can definitely see the beginning of the end. I mean, I think they knew it was going to happen, you know, even by the time of Saturday Night Live, you know.
Look, that was when Tim came out.
Yes. Yeah, well, remember, he got, Saturday Night Live was, I believe, January of 86, and he got fired in August. So it wasn't that much later.
Do you have any Kickstarter campaigns going on right now, other than the movie? Anything that people should be...
Well, just this one. We've got the final one for this one. which is just basically for, like, you know, help with the film festival admission fees and things like that, you know, where they can get still, like, I mean, there's probably 20 different backer rewards, you know, anything and everything you could possibly want is on there. And if they go to our website, callmeobsessed.com, lower right-hand corner, there's a button that says Get Involved, and that's the Kickstarter button. Definitely check the website, because on Wednesday we're going to announce that we're also in, there's a really good festival in Boston. They were playing, like, our first five shows are Tampa, Madison, Wisconsin, Chicago, Boston, and then the Minneapolis show.
I'm impressed that you even know where the hell you're going at this point.
Me too, to be honest with you. If this was video, you'd see the piles of crap on my desk right now that I've got to sort through to make sure.
It's Saturday morning. A Replacements fan should be finding himself on some random couch.
I'm a little too old for that.
You're ahead of the game.
You know, but... In terms of the DVD, and anyone who likes it, if people are interested in, like, my ranting about filmmaking stuff, the commentaries on my last two movies, I really go off on. I try to make it a film lecture more than anything. And everything from how we raised the money, because in both those cases we actually raised money, to what we used, to dealing with crew, to casting. I mean, I'm not just there like saying, oh, this actress is wonderful, she did such a great job. I don't do any of that crap. I basically, you know, I try to hopefully help someone who's, you know, looking, you know, to make a movie. And also my cinematographer on the last movie, Friends with Benefits, which people can watch streaming pretty much everywhere, like Netflix or Fancast or Babblegum. He does also a great commentary on the DVD, literally going into all the lighting and everything and how things were lit and, you know, doing stuff, making stuff look good on a small budget. I mean, in fact, my new movie, the one I started shooting another narrative feature, the one I was telling you that we're sort of going without the script. And on the first day of shooting, I wanted to, like, see how it worked. I was my entire crew. It was me and the actress. I did sound, I did lighting, I did camera. And my DP saw it, my normal DP saw it yesterday, and he was just like, how did you like this? And I'm like, every single thing was lit with one light. And if you know what you're doing, that's all you need. You know, you can make one light look like five.
That's art in the 21st century, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, it's like sometimes I remember watching a James Wong Ho, if I'm saying his name right, was a famous old cinematographer, and he did this, like, little video on lighting. And I remember watching it, and it's like he's adding, like, you know, he's in a studio setting. He's adding, like, 15 lights to the scene, and I'm thinking to myself, it could have been done with two. I mean, you know, I think sometimes it's, you know, it's so much of it is overkill, you know, and literally if the sun is out and you can use it, there's no better light in the world. You know?
Right.
Gorman Bichard, thank you for being our guest today.
Hey, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And now it's time for the endorsement section of the podcast, where we each recommend something that we have been enjoying lately. Jason.
I am going to recommend. I'm going
masturbating.
Hold on, give me 55 seconds. I'll be back. I'm going to endorse a book. You guys know I don't really read, right?
Here.
I know, seriously, right? You know I don't really read, but I picked up The War for Late Night. By Bill Carter. Did either of you read The Late Shift?
Yes.
No, I saw the show.
Okay, I have not. I never saw the movie version of it, but
John Michael Higgins' Letterman was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to check it out. But I did read The Late Shift back in the 90s when it came out, and this book, Bill Carter is such a great writer. I mean, he's got access to everybody who is a part of the whole debacle. Everybody.
It's a really fascinating subject. I think you'd have to try hard to fuck it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, he does... I don't know if he has direct contact to Letterman, but I know he's had direct contact to Leno, to Conan, to Kimmel, to everybody. I mean, it's been...
Anybody bother talking to Carson Daly?
I don't think Carson Daly even got a mention. Craig Ferguson does. Fallon obviously gets mentioned. Even George Lopez, I think, might have gotten a mention.
Not Carson Daly.
Well, but to be fair, I think Lopez was only mentioned in the context of Conan's new show. But
to be fair, Carson Daly sucks.
You know, it's interesting. I went into the book feeling like I was going to come out against Leno, and I'm not.
Don't say it. Oh.
No. You read it and you let me know whether you think that Leno is truly to blame in this situation. I
feel like this is the scene in Godfather Part 2 where I'm supposed to kiss you and say you broke my heart and then order your assassination.
I don't want to see him again unless Michael Parr is in the room.
Jeff, I hope you come back on the podcast at some point and talk about when you've read this book, because I think you would love it. I think you would love it. You feel like you're there in the back room with all this stuff going on, you know, for each situation. But I didn't come out of it do I think Leno made some bad moves? Yes, but I also think Conan made some bad moves. And if you're going to blame anybody for the whole thing, it's going to be Jeff Zucker.
Jeff Zucker. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so, I just blame Leno for sucking.
You can blame Leno for sucking, but at the end of the day, it's what everybody wanted.
That makes me so angry.
Well, that's totally fair. But I don't think, at the end of the day, after reading this book especially, I don't think it's Leno's fault that things ended up the way he did. I mean, when you look at it, you know, Leno was on top of the ratings.
It's Leno's fault that he's not funny.
I understand that Leno didn't want to lose his job and all that
stuff. He didn't
want to
leave.
Of course not. Who wants to be unemployed?
But at the same time,
you know what? Then he should have fucking kept his mouth. He should have said something in 2004 when this decision was made.
I think what happened in 2004, you know, I think his persona of, you know, you just do the job that you're given is real for him. And I think he thought...
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
You know, they said to him, we're going to give Conan the show. He didn't want the network to lose Conan because they were afraid that Conan was going to go to Fox. So they said to Leno, we have to give Conan the Tonight Show. And Leno went, okay. You know?
Okay, then you know what? You got 5 years to negotiate with another network.
But that was the thing, Dave. That's the thing that the book talks about, is that the reason that they moved Leno to 10 was because it looked like he was going to go to ABC. And Zucker didn't want to lose Leno because he knew that if Leno went to ABC, he'd be going up directly against Conan, and that Leno's ratings were through the roof. I mean, Leno's ratings beat Letterman out every night.
Right. Ugh.
I just want to get back to the real crucial point here. You say that Leno just does his job. Leno's job is to be funny, goddammit, and he doesn't do his job.
Well, he doesn't do it for you, but he doesn't do it for me. But for Middle America, where he's touring 100 and some odd days out of the year, he does it for them.
Can't somebody just start a TV network in Branson, and then he can just stay there? He can have the Osmonds on every night.
I highly recommend this is a good discussion, and the book really lays it out. It lays out the entire thing, so I can't recommend it highly enough. I really couldn't put it down. So,
all right.
First thing I remember, I was lying in my bed. Couldn't have been no more than one or two. And I remember there was a radio coming from the room next door. My mother laughed the way some ladies do. When it's late in the evening and the music seeping through.
Jeff.
Oh, what have I been loving? I've been playing the hell out of the new Emmylou Harris record.
Ooh.
I'm stunned that nobody on the Popdos staff wants to review it.
I saw her do a Tiny Desk concert for NPR, or a small concert at South by Southwest, where it was just her and her guitar doing the song that she wrote for Kate McGarrigle. I think it's called Dear Kate.
Uh-huh.
And it's Emmylou. You know, it's gorgeous, so I'm just really looking forward to hearing the rest of it.
Yeah, it's good. It's all very pretty, and there are a couple up-tempo tracks, but mostly it's brunch music. It's just very nice. I mean, I've never really been an Emmylou fan, and I just happened to get this in the mail, but I really liked it. And then tonight, I played the new one by Ha Ha Tonka.
Hmm.
By who?
Who?
Dug the fuck out of.
I've heard. I get confused between them and Ra Ra Riot. But I've liked what I've heard out of both those bands.
I wish they'd go on tour together. That's great. That's a wonderful idea.
They could play Radio Gaga.
Yes. Ha ha Tonka. They're
and the best and the greatest hits of the Laz.
They play kind of Appalachian rock, Southern Appalachian. It's music that sounds like it came out of a mason jar. You may not like it, Jason. I liked it a lot, though.
Who produced the Emmylou record?
Jay Joyce, who, much to my surprise, our colleague Ken Shane had never heard of, but he's produced a lot of stuff for Nancy Griffith.
Okay.
So same sort of axis, but you know, it doesn't sound. I mean, it like you think of Nancy Griffith and her sound is very clean, but. And you think of Emmylou Harris, and her sound is much more atmospheric. And this new one does not really deviate from what you think of when you think of Emmylou Harris. It's still, you know, it's the kind of record, like if I told you that Malcolm Byrne or Daniel Lanois produced it, you wouldn't be surprised.
I can still remember every song you played long ago when we were younger and we rocked the night. How could I see a future then where you would not grow with such a fire in our belly, such a hunger in our soul? I guess I probably loved you when those words rolled off your tongue. It seemed that we were trailing under some old lucky sun. I know I couldn't save you, and no.
The baseball season's just started, so I'm going to recommend Volume 2, High and Inside, the new album by The Baseball Project. It's a supergroup of sorts. Scott McCoy of the Young Fresh Fellows and Steve Wynn of the Dream Syndicate. They write the songs. Peter Buck of REM is on bass and Linda Pittman is on drums. They released their first album 3 years ago, and last year they did a song a month during the baseball season for ESPN.com. If you're a baseball fan, you know, you'll like these songs because they're about the human condition as told through the history of the game. And, you know, there's some of the songs are funny, some are nostalgic, some are sad and wistful. I just think there's
probably they all last for at least 3 hours.
I think there's a really strong, it's probably the best and most consistent. This and you know, their other album and a half or so are probably the best marriage of writing about sports and rock and roll that I've ever heard. It's just, you know, the songs are melodic and smart as pop songs. I mean, yeah, you know, Scott McCoy has kind of a bit of an annoying voice. But he really understands, I think, how to write a really good song, and I just think it's a very strong record. There's one about a great song about Bill Buckner, how he was vilified after 1986 when he let the ball go through his legs. But it says, but it basically takes you through Bob Ojeda having a meltdown and being traded for Calvin Schiraldi, in the off season, and you know all the things that led up to that moment. Why didn't John McNamara put in the defensive replacement? Why didn't, if they hadn't had the wild pitch before that, you know? And then it said that Buckner, look at what Buckner did throughout his entire career. This guy was a great player, and you know, probably even borderline Hall of Fame, but he's remembered most for this one thing that he did in a situation that he shouldn't have been put in. And it says, and I think the last line is something like that, maybe he was lucky that his luck was so rotten. Because now he is remembered and he is part of the game's lore. And you know, so it's stuff like that. It really gets you to think about the game. And there's the opening song is called 1976, which is about learning that Mark Fidrich had died. Mark Fidrich, who was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers and who was kind of like a young phenom. He was kind of a very weird character. He had like long blonde curly hair and used to talk to the baseball and smooth the dirt on the mound and stuff. And he had a rookie year, and the next year he blew out his arm, unfortunately, and he was, you know, he was out of the game, like right after that. He never came back from it. And but it's also about like the idea of, you know, these memories that we have and how they fade with, you know, and you know, like the sense of our own mortality that we get when we hear that somebody from our past has died. Mm.
That's a sensation that you have often felt combing the obituary section, right, Dave?
What I do is I glad. All right, good. I outlived that one.
What's the name of this album again?
Volume 2, High and Inside. The band is called The Baseball Project.
High and Inside. That's the state I was in with your mom last night.
Two balls deep.
The ball went through my legs.
You Buckner'd it.
Buckner'd your mom.
This is what happens when we record at night.
Another winning episode.
Jason's all high on cranberry juice.
That's right. Yes. I got to go put some more lime juice in this.
Giddy on Capri Sun.
Good. So I've had to go to the can for a fucking hour and a half now.
I thought you kept a bottle or a can or something. Or don't you have a bedpan anyway?
Set against a fading Motor City and Richard Nixon chain. A rock star had arrived. Vidridge comes alive. And I know that it's hardly fair to say you won't grow old. But forgive me if I try.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Pop Dust Podcast. Once again, our thanks to Gorman Bichard for appearing on the show. You can learn more about Color Me Obsessed by going to colormeobsessed.com, and we will have a link to it in the show notes over at popdust.com. We'll also have a link to it in the show notes over at popdust.com. And while you're there, you can either talk about your own thoughts about the Replacements or give your own answers to the questions that we discussed in the first half over in the comment section. If you are new to the show, you can find... She's a motherfucker.
I'll do it. I'll take it. If you're new to the show, you can find archived episodes of the show over on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us a comment, because the more comments we get, the higher profile our podcast becomes. And... yeah.
You can also follow us on Twitter at PopDose. No point in saying twitter.com/PopDose anymore, because everybody knows that it's just the at symbol.
That's true. At Facebook. And I'm sorry, I tried to steal your outro. What a mess.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's okay. I don't mind.
The job is harder than it looks, Jason.
Damn right.
There's a mom joke in there, too. Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, gentlemen. And
yes.
And what shall we discuss in the month of May?
Well, we got Mother's Day coming up.
That's
using the same joke that Jason used last year.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll have to think about it. Go ahead and leave us a comment as to what we should talk about next month. I say as if any of you will actually leave a comment as to what we're going to talk about next month.
Right. Give us suggestions, because we really have no fucking idea what we're doing. Right.
My vote's for Mother's Day.
I still think we should get our moms
get
on the show.
Get our moms on the show?
Get our moms off on the show.
I'll see. I could probably get my mom to do an episode, but we'd have to behave ourselves.
I know I couldn't, because I just couldn't deal with the technology, trying to explain the technology to her.
Oh, see, I'd have my mom, like, I'd have her come over and we would just chat on the same microphone.
Yeah, my mom lives in Florida. That's not easy to do.
Come over and sit on Jason's lap.
A welcome respite from my face. So,
we'll
get back to you about next. We'll get back to you about next month.
All right. All right. Have a good one, everybody.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Did you at all speak to Jim Walsh?
No.
Who wrote
Nope.
All about, okay. Because I interviewed him a few years ago when that book came out, and when I read it, I thought it did a fantastic job of basically putting me in Minneapolis in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you had a...
No, I've actually never...
If he had shared any stories with you.
No, I never even got past the first chapter.
Oh, oh really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Have you
this
started?
Is one of those things that'll get edited out.
No, you can put it in there. I don't. It doesn't make any difference to me.
So what do you got, Dave?
Chlamydia. And gout.
And gout. Polio.
You're
the FDR of the Pop Dose podcast.
Your reference to me having gout a while ago was beautiful. All right. Well,
we should replace Dave's picture on that front banner with Wilford Brimley.
You can say with FDR.
I was just thinking Wilford Brimley would be like, you know, we have a picture of you, a picture of me, and then Wilford Brimley.
The Pop Dose podcast, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.